What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. Hello there, John.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I am going to be quick about setting up this next conversation on America Trends because the issues it raises are so interesting, so nuanced, and require full unpacking order to understand.
Yeah, better unpack this one.
Well, I've got a big suitcase here, and we're going to unpack the whole thing. But let's start here. There is a sense of the scene. You ever hear of that, you know, or when they say the state of play?
Right, okay.
Or conventional wisdom.
Right, right.
In many realms, there are things that we take for granted. They're often called, what is common knowledge? We call them that?
Yeah.
Accepted truths.
Right, yeah. Okay. I'm following you.
Undeniable bodies of evidence that when put to fuller scrutiny are just wrong or totally simplistic. Now, how often is that the case? You say, oh, yeah, I understand that. And then somebody begins to unpack the suitcase.
Uh-oh.
And you realize, I had no idea it was that complicated.
We're in for a rude awakening here.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, let me give you a convenient shorthand for all this. It's called bad recounting of history. And we have a lot of that where we simplify it. We put it into a book and we're always the good guys and they're always the bad guys. Or depending upon whose perspective it is. And there is actually a title for that or a name for that. It's called historiography.
Well, I think the movies help us with that too. Rewriting history quite often.
They do. Yeah, right.
They do.
Yeah. No, you're right. It was Gone with the Wind. Was that a historical account? Well, think about the Civil War now that we're at that period of the Civil War. And if you listen to certain people, not many historians, they'll tell you, well, what was the Civil War about? And they'll say, oh, it was all about slavery. But really, when you think about it, it was about two differing economic systems, one that happened to be built on slavery. But the Emancipation Proclamation came along after the war had well begun. So it didn't start out that way. It morphed as it went along, because unless you took out slavery, then you really couldn't change the economic systems that were both fighting each other, the industrial and the agricultural. And there are differences in historical perspective based upon where you sat at the time. So if you still read an account of the Civil War written by a Southern white male slaveholder versus an emancipated slave, I think you'd get a very different perspective.
You'd get a very different perspective, yes.
Exactly. Or an abolitionist in New England.
Right.
Well, this was really interesting for me because I went to a talk at my temple, this was an incredible talk about Black Power Jewish politics. And it's by Mark Dollinger. That's the book.
Okay.
And he was fascinating. He was wonderful to listen to. He really engaged the audience. And I taped the whole thing thinking maybe we could make a podcast out of this. But because we didn't have the right miking for the audience and all, I had to go back and interview him again. And I found it to be absolutely more revealing, only because for me, it was very interesting what happened in the 1960s. But then I wanted to bring it up to the present day. And he's a historian. And not that he was reluctant to talk about the present, but he said, we have enough trouble figuring out the past, let alone telling you what's happening today in real time. But he did an incredible job with us.
Wow,
so
you've piqued my interest here.
Well, you're going to like this, John. You really are. But I think the common thought was that civil rights movement, that African Americans and Jewish Americans were walking arm in arm together throughout the entire process. But Mark Dollinger points out that that wasn't exactly the case. But we have this fond memory of that occurring.
So that didn't happen?
Not quite that way. But I'm going to let him tell the story because it is nuanced. It is interesting. It's worth your time. Believe me. Here on America Trends, we're going to talk about Black Power and Jewish politics.
We welcome to America Trends Mark Dollinger, a professor from San Francisco State University, and he's written a very interesting book called Black Power, Jewish Politics. And I'm just wondering, I know a lot of us think, as we look back to those days in the 60s and perhaps early 70s, that blacks and Jews really were hand in hand, arm in arm, as it relates to the civil rights movement. But you tell us that perhaps the story that we have is not as accurate as we think.
Most of us remember, either because we lived through it or we've sort of read the literature on it, that it was sort of an idyllic bonding between two oppressed groups who shared a common history and a common experience in America, and of course then that led them to a common vision, which they realized in the Black Jewish Alliance of the Civil Rights Movement. At least I was raised, you know, in the 1970s with that idea. But when I went into the archives and then I started looking in the primary sources, a very different story emerged.
And what was that story? I mean, what was the disconnect that we have about it? Was it the fact that whiteness and blackness were really more the issues than Jewish and black at that time? What were the issues?
Yeah, so my research actually kind of went in reverse chronological order. I was actually interested in the Jewish ethnic and religious revival of the late 60s and into the 1970s. I was interested in why American Jews became interested in Zionism, especially after the 1967 war. I knew a whole lot of kids who kind of grew up in that era, became more religiously traditional than their parents. I was raised around the Soviet Jewry movement and was active in that, you know, during my teenage years. And I saw all of these things coming together, so I was kind of looking to figure out where they came from. And my surprise was reading how many Jewish leaders credited the Black Power movement for informing their own Jewish activism. And with that, I got curious. I started moving backwards in time, and I started looking into the mid-60s. And growing up, I'd kind of heard that, you know, Black anti-Semitism spiked in the mid-60s, and Jews were kicked out of the civil rights movements, organizations that they had led for years before, and it was sort of a tragic story of sort of white liberal Jews helping and blacks not appreciating them enough. You know, at least that was the version I had. And then the archival material actually told a very different story. It told about, these are actually white males, you know, middle-aged and older Jewish leaders telling their constituents that Black anti-Semitism is not a threat, that there are deep social, economic, and race-based issues in 1960s America, that they really saw the split between Blacks and Jews as inevitable based upon those differences, and they were not nearly as hostile as at least I was taught. And then I just kept pushing back in history and found out in the early 60s and even in the 1950s, white male Jewish leaders were publicly announcing that the time will soon come when the Black Jewish Alliance will split because of the essential racial differences and white supremacy, basically, of America. And I found Jewish organizations having strong support for organizations such as the Nation of Islam, which I found shocking given, you know, what's going on with Louis Farrakhan. So basically, you know, I researched backwards. I wrote, you know, from chapter one in the 50s forward, and it ended up being pretty much a total revision of the way I was raised prepared to learn about the civil rights movement.
I'm just curious, how controversial in academic circles is your contention that this alliance is more about what you call historical memory than reality on the ground?
Yeah, so here's perhaps the sad truth. In scholarly circles, they're actually more bored by the thesis, in that they find it unsurprising, and it's actually consistent with lots of other scholarship, you know, from certainly the 1960s. I found when I brought it into sort of larger white liberal Jewish community, there's greater discomfort. sort of, you know, synagogues and JCCs and when I'm on the book tour, because, you know, these are folks who either lived it, so they have their own personal memory, or they were raised with a certain version, and then this guy kind of stands up and starts, you know, reading all these quotations that really, you know, are for them an assault on their own memory. And that sometimes can be tough to digest.
Now, there are three areas advanced for why Jews would involve themselves in the struggle for racial equality. You say that they're all false. Let's go to the historical argument that Jews are involved because of social justice, civil rights, because of a shared history of oppression. Why is that not on target?
Yeah, well, we'll start with sort of what works about the argument, and then we'll kind of break it down. So the theory I had, certainly when I went to religious school growing up, was that the history of Jews is the history of oppression and, of course, slavery in ancient Egypt. And Jews of all people are supposed to remember that they too were slaves in the land of Egypt. So when we as white Jews look at African Americans and the African American experience, we see that kinship of understanding what it is to be marginalized and even enslaved. And then, as a scholar, you know, I realized you can't really make a comparison between Jewish slavery in the ancient period and African and African American slavery in the modern period, nor does it actually attach to American Jewish history, where, at least for the Eastern Europeans and even for the Central Europeans earlier, the second generation learned English as the kids of the immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, they went through school. If they didn't get through high school and college, their kids got through high school, college, and graduate school. It was sort of a meteoric rise by the late 1950s. The anti-Semitic stuff that had been horrible in the 20s and 30s had all but disappeared. So while the history argument for American Jews was the story of rapid social mobility, the history argument for African Americans was centuries of slavery, followed by Jim Crow segregation, you know, followed by continued institutional racism, which, you know, sadly we still have today. One of my African American colleagues, a sociologist, you know, very involved in Black Jewish. He's an African American man. He's very involved in Black Jewish relations, and he teases me. He says, if I go to another Passover Seder and I hear the white Jews tell me that they know what it's like to be a Black man in America because they too were slaves in the land of Egypt, I'm going to scream, you know. So the history argument not only isn't symmetric, the history argument is opposite between what it is to be a white Jew and an African American.
What about the sociological argument? Both groups experienced social marginalization in the 1950s. As the civil rights movement was developing, Jews were, however, already to some extent moving into the more mainstream. Is that the problem? That, I mean, this just doesn't link up.
Yeah, this is, of course, related to the history argument, because it's a history of being marginal. The sociology argument about marginality, we'll just, it's an excellent time you said. Let's just take the 1950s, because this is the time when the blacks and the Jews joined in the civil rights movement. And this is where one would think that outsiderness is, you know, drew them together. Eric Goldstein, who's a professor at Emory University, in his excellent book called The Price of Whiteness, made the argument that Jews could only enter an alliance across the racial divide once Jews themselves had sort of become white, which in this case means become accepted and powerful and integrated. And that's why the Black Jewish Alliance didn't happen in the 1920s or 30s. There's too much anti-Semitism. But by the 1950s, when anti-Semitism was dropping precipitously, Jews had enough security to reach across the divide to help African Americans. So, you know, that's the one piece. The second piece is more troubling and concerning. You know, it was part of the American dream, at least I think for, like, you know, the Jewish immigrants and their kids, was, you know, to get a good education, get a good job, and own a home. And they couldn't own homes because they didn't have enough money, and they couldn't own homes because they were anti-Semitic restrictive housing covenants. But by the 50s, they had the money, and the covenants, you know, became, you know, not anti-Semitic. So the Jews moved to the suburbs, And what I knew growing up, or what I thought I knew, realizing the American dream as a good thing, and it was realizing the American dream, put white Jews into racially exclusive suburbs because African Americans still were prohibited from buying through the housing covenants. And even if there wasn't a housing covenant, if a black family moved in, all the whites would move out because the terrible racist joke was there goes the neighborhood. So Jews, in achieving their American dream, actually became complicit in racism. And that occurring at the moment of the alliance between blacks and Jews is what many of the Jewish leaders were saying. Like structurally, the sociological realities of blacks and Jews are actually more different in the 1950s than similar.
What about the notion that Jews vote more so as Democrats than Republicans, which might be against some personal economic self-interest because they are concerned sociologically about others, and that that's part of the Jewish ethos? That to some degree gets into your religious argument about Tikkun Olam, the religion speaking to the sanctity of social justice. It's funny. I mean, wasn't there some tie there?
Yeah. Milton Hamilton had a famous quote that, Jews, live like Presbyterians but vote like Puerto Ricans. The notion that as you move up the economic ladder, you're supposed to move to the right politically, and other, ethnic groups from Europe to the U.S. sort of followed that pattern, and the Jews, it seems, did not follow that pattern. And this is really a question for the political scientists, but in my reading of the work, it actually becomes more complex. What one has to do is actually segment American Jewish voters, which is to say, since New York City and its environs is so dense with American Jews, there's a concept that New York Jewish voting is American Jewish voting. And clearly, if you do the data, something like 80% of American Jews from the 1928 election up until now are voting for Democratic candidates. So it does appear to follow Himmelfarb's, famous quote. In reality, I tell my students, imagine you wrote a book on Jews and politics, but New York only gets one chapter. And then L.A. gets a chapter, and a small town in Mississippi gets a chapter, and we'll give Chicago a chapter. When you do this, what you find is that white Southern Jews embraced Dixie from the time that they settled in the middle of the 19th century. And we know, some became slave owners, some became members of the White Citizens Council. To be clear, a lot of them also became civil rights activists, though most of the activists, almost all of them, came from the North. So I found that politics for Jews is more informed by the larger culture that surrounded them than it was necessarily any sort of organic Jewish religious thing, because if Judaism is what was supposed to bring blacks and Jews together in Tikkun Olam, one would expect America's Orthodox Jews to be in the lead with Dr. King, because they are the ones for whom a traditional interpretation of Jewish law governs their everyday. Yet, when you read the sources, there are almost no Orthodox Jews. They don't actually consider civil rights to be even part of what we would now call Tikkun Olam. The conservative movement, most famously, was Rabbi Heschel. And what people forget about Rabbi Heschel was that he was actually rebuked by his own seminary for having taken such an interest in what was considered a secular cause by many. And he opposed the Vietnam War as well. And they thought, you're going off doing your secular politics when you should be a rabbi in a seminary. Come back to your people. The Reform Movement, the least tradition-bound of the denominations, had the highest number of Jews involved. And as I joke with my students, after I find, this is on a podcast, but it's okay, I have tenure, it was actually Jewish socialists and communists who were the ones who were most engaged in the direct action protests of the 50s and 60s. And even though they were Jewish and perhaps the Judaism came through their leftist politics, and it did, it wasn't the kind of Judaism that religionists would normally consider, Tikkun Olam. Yet, sort of religious Jews today kind of lay claim to all of those activists who went to the South, even though if you would have interviewed the activists at the time, they were there as part of, you know, the, you know, one of the civil rights organizations, the South NAACP, SCLC, Urban League, or something like that.
Isn't that often the case, though, what you talked about with the Orthodox Jews, that they weren't the ones on the front lines of civil rights, very inward-looking, but when you look at those who integrate more into the society, in this case conservative and reformed Jews, less defined only by, say, the strict construction of the teachings, but reaching out more to the world, is that not the norm?
Yes, and I would argue that you're absolutely right, that the way in which different denominations approach civil rights reflects the denominational view of what Judaism is. Reform is all about mixing modernity with Judaism to figure out what it will look like in the modern period. And clearly, racism is not something that a modern Reform Jew would like to see. The conservative movement would like to stay within the halakha, within the Jewish law, understanding that some changes are going to have to be made in the modern period, and they're sort of struggling with how to maintain fidelity to Jewish law while also operating. I mean, most famously in the 1950s, when so many conservative Jews moved to the suburbs and couldn't walk to synagogue, the rabbis of the conservative movement gave permission for conservative Jews to drive on the Sabbath, of course, provided that they were only driving to shul to pray and only driving home. You can't stop and shop on the way. That doesn't count. And the Orthodox, of course, remained completely committed to living the traditional Jewish lifestyle. And for them, the notion of breaking out into secular politics was antagonistic to what they believed Judaism should be.
The book is called Black Power, Jewish Politics, Reinventing the Alliance in the 1960s. You say that the American Jewish leaders drew a whole lot of inspiration from Black Power movements at the time, that the Black Jewish Alliance was splintering, and that the rise of this Black nationalism helped to inform Jewish political movements, including in the Soviet Union, as well as a spike in Jewish support for Israel, best exemplified by the reaction to the 1967 war. Tell us how this happened. Give us a sense at the time what was going on.
Yeah, so my sort of career thesis is that Jewish politics will follow the larger cultural politics of the time and the place. So if we start in the 1950s and Jews, you know, got into these white Christian suburbs, they are going to be as white and Christian as they can in their politics because that's the world in which they're living. In my first book, I found some stories where some public schools were singing Christmas carols, and the, you know, Anti-Defamation League got really upset and went to the principal, you know, church-state separation, you can't have Jewish kids singing Christmas carols, until the parents of the Jewish kids called the Anti-Defamation League and complained, let our kids sing Christmas carols. We want us to get admitted and accepted here, and that's what we want. So in the 50s, assimilating one's Jewishness was the dominant political trend. What happened in the 60s, was, of course, with Dr. King, was this notion that it is okay to be different. Pluralism and diversity should be embraced. And then what, you know, Stokely Carmichael and the Black Power activists, they took it to the next step, which is to say, take it to the streets and be proud. I mean, Black Power, Black Pride, Black is beautiful, all of these slogans. And what happened was these Jewish leaders who had spent the last decade being really quiet about their Jewishness saw that Blacks were in the streets and Latinos were in the streets with Mecha, and women were in the streets with the second wave feminist movement. And they're like, why shouldn't Jews be in the streets too? Why can't we internalize the message that Jewish pride, like Black pride, is okay in a pluralistic American democracy? So the Soviet Jewry movement went national in 1964. And of course, the way you get support for Soviet Jewry movement is you play on the anti-communism. U.S. Senate is probably more interested in beating the commies than they are helping the Jews, so play that. And I argue that if you wanted to play anti-communism to help the Jews of Russia, of the USSR, you should have done it in 1954 instead of 1964, because this is the height of McCarthyism. But in the 50s, the last thing these suburban Jews wanted was to scream and yell and demonstrate in the streets that they're Jews, right? Because they were calling the ADL saying, stay away from Christmas carols. But thanks to watching Black Power mobilize, Jews said, we're going to mobilize for Soviet Jews. Now, they used to mobilize for blacks in the Deep South, but part of Black Power was to say, and you can't have white people controlling black organizations. And famously, you know, a Jewish woman goes to Malcolm X to say, well, you know, you don't want me. What should I do? Well, she could go in your community and sort of teach white folks about what's going on with racism. And then rabbis said, I'm going to go into the Jewish communities. I'm going to teach them that they can and should in America be more public. And then they started wearing kippot. I write that the second most popular book published by Jewish Publication Society after the Torah was the Jewish catalog, which is sort of how to be Jewish using macrame, combining power culture, arts and crafts, DIY with public expressions of Jewishness. And of course, the kids who bought the Jewish catalog only had to buy it because they were raised in the 50s and their parents didn't teach them this stuff. And there was this, you know, there's a Jewish catalog 2 and 3. There was no Jewish catalog 4 because by the time those years rolled by, the kids who bought Jewish catalog 1, you know, got married, had kids, they sent them to Jewish day school or synagogue or Jewish summer camp, and they had their identities. They didn't need to buy no book to get a Jewish identity.
Interesting. Well, you are an historian, and I, of course, am doing this podcast about trends, where we are headed. So I know we're going into a territory that perhaps is not as familiar to you, but you are a living, breathing, thinking individual in America today. And with hate crimes on the rise in America, and we see assaults on churches and synagogues, do you feel that any of the old, even perceived coalition or perceived interests of blacks and Jews might actually come together in a different manner in the year 2019 than in the past, but that where there might be a coming together given a common assault on both groups or other in our society? And of course, you know, do Jews consider themselves others still would be a question that I'd also ask you to respond to.
That is such an excellent question. I'm glad we have 9 hours to talk about it. It is so important and so prescient and to see what's going on. So my joke is I'm an historian. It's hard enough predicting the past, but I can't predict the future. That said, there is an application. So my theory is that Jewish politics follow the politics of the world around them. So let's just talk about the politics of a world now which is seeing increased anti-Semitism in the U.S. and in Europe, you know, and abroad in the Arab world. And now, given the fact that this generation, especially of young American Jews, are living in a time and an era that only their grandparents would have had their version of, you know, of understanding, there is a big opportunity for alliance. And just informally, as I've been sort of going around, I've heard of lots of new opportunities for white Jews to join an alliance with different communities of color, because there is now a sense of shared marginality and a sense of this ethic of tikkun olam that Jews have to do this. As you point out, there's a complication, and that is white Jews are at the same time privileged and persecuted. Privileged because of this impressive social mobility, and Jews who are white are conferred with this privilege, and that will always, you know, sort of make my African American colleague, you know, laugh about slaves in Egypt comments. On the other hand, even though Jews are white and privileged, anti-Semitism is at like a 50-year high or low, however you want to call that. And for that reason, there is a sense of solidarity with other communities. So what's happening now among sort of the leading group of Jewish social justice activists is they're entering into alliances with African American and Latino organizations, fully understanding that for most of them they're white, and that that has impact and that they need to pay attention to that, while at the same time doing the most they can to create a country that's good for everyone. And with that, I just sort of want to open up what I think is the next generation of scholarship and activism on this topic. And this is Jews of color, who are an increasing number of American Jews, and especially for African American Jews, this notion of an alliance is created by white Jews, because if you're black and Jewish, the alliance is purely internal. And it sort of asks the fundamental question, what kind of interracial alliance is there if Jews are themselves becoming interracial? And to what extent does a Jewish person who is living the experience of blackness in America at the same time they're living the experience of Jewishness and really inside an organized Jewish world, which is almost all white, how do they navigate? So I'm looking to folks like Ilana Kaufman, organizations like B'chol Lashon, which are doing the research and the work to sort of press these questions to give, you know, sort of much deeper and better insights into what the dynamics are that we tend not to investigate as much without thinking about it.
According to the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, 57% of Jews support Black Lives Matter. That's the second highest of any faith group after the Muslims. We've also, though, seen a schism in the women's movement that developed right after Donald Trump was inaugurated. And the question there is, and I'll bring you back historically, it was really fascinating in your writing to see that the group that gained the most from affirmative action in the 1960s were Jewish women, and they also have some of the greatest sense of social justice. Put all of that together for us. What are we seeing here?
Oh, wow. Okay, that's another good 9-hour question. So the comment about affirmative action, affirmative action ostensibly was to help communities of color, and the point I make is that the greatest beneficiary of affirmative action were white people, not people of color, and that's somewhat surprising to folks. Unless one reads this, and then it's actually not surprising at all. And the white group that benefited most were Jews, even though Jews were not considered a designated minority group by U.S. federal government standards. And that's because women were considered a designated minority group, and white Jewish women were the best prepared to take advantage of college, graduate school, and professional placements. So that example is an example of how white Jews can kind of leapfrog ahead of communities of color, even when the government programs are supposed to do the opposite. And then let's play that sort of theory into what's going on today, which is oppressed people wish to fight against oppressors. And I think Jews as an oppressed people would also like to fight against oppressors. So now, and when we say Women's March, it's actually one small part of the radical feminist community, which yes. is engaged with this, and it's received a whole lot more publicity as if it's more generalized and more normalized. It really intersects, well, generally with white privilege, but more specifically with Zionism. Among these radical leftists, Zionism is racism. Therefore, inviting anyone who is Zionist into your march or into your political alliance is inviting racists in. And if one believes that, and for the sake of this argument, we have to go with the fact that these folks believe it, their mission demands that they reject racism. So their mission demands that they reject Zionists, which means they're either rejecting Jews, or they're rejecting most Jews, or they're rejecting Jews unless the Jews themselves say that they're anti-Zionist, which is itself problematic. So now, Jews who are white and Zionist and have a sense of social justice or having to navigate within some communities of the far left that believe it's an oxymoron to be what I would call a progressive Zionist, that there is no such thing as even a Zionist who would like to see a two-state solution, for example. And that's what we're seeing playing out.
when we do see Representative Omar and some of the backlash against her in the Jewish community, we see the Republicans trying to take some advantage of that. And particularly we see a president who's always embracing the prime minister of Israel. Put that together for us as it relates to the Jewish feelings in America about Israel and its policies related to the Palestinians.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. The best place to, I'm trained in American Jewish history and in Jewish studies, so I want to answer from that perspective.
Sure.
And that's to say that the difference between Israeli Jews and American Jews is a whole lot bigger and deeper than at least I was raised thinking. Because I kind of thought Jews around the world, we're all Jews, we're all together. You know, the slogan of the United Jewish Appeal back in the day was, "We are one." And you would go to Israel on your pilgrimage for your bar mitzvah, your confirmation, whatever it was. And there, you know, you would finally be home. This was the notion. The truth is, half of Israeli Jews do not self-define as religious, that the continuum of religiosity in Israel is either Orthodox or secular. American Jews have these denominations all across the middle ground of religiosity. And if you are a secular nationalist Jewish Israeli, as 80% are, you are fundamentally different than a reform or conservative or secular cultural American Jew. And the divide between those two identities of Jews comes with Bibi and Trump. Because Bibi and Trump, Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, are on the political right, and they are super nationalist. Therefore, the nationalist Israeli Jews are going to love Netanyahu and they're going to love Trump because he moved the embassy to Jerusalem. And that's where it should be. And even though most American Jews think that Jerusalem is the capital, they're coming from U.S. history and they're coming from the 60s and they're coming from diversity and pluralism and liberalism and a rights-based approach to democracy. And they are going to reject the nationalism of Trump because they know that that leads to racism and sexism and anti-Semitism. And they're going to reject the same thing in Netanyahu because they're going to see this as a one-state, all-Jewish, you know, occupying force would be the language that they would use. And on the surface, you know, this is a Bibi Trump thing, but I think very quickly it gets at the heart of why American Jews generally are different than Israeli Jews. And that's a much harder question for the American Jewish community to have to, you know, inhale and exhale about.
One more tough one. Some say there's a generational divide going on in America as younger Jews criticize and accept criticism of Israel more than the older Jewish generation. Millennials in general, fewer than half sympathize with Israel. What does that portend?
Well, so the answer to that is actually yes and no. I'll start with the no, and then I'll get to the yes, which is I think the answer you're looking for. The no is that every generation of young Jews have had their version of, now, if not now, is sort of the leading trending group now. There was the New Jewish Agenda, you know, that was out earlier, Peace Now, Shalom Akshav, and each constituted itself in its time to sort of go against the organized Jewish bureaucracy's views towards Israel. So in that sense, at least since the mid-60s, I have actually seen this every generation doing itself. The other truth is that my grandparents' generation, you know, that was the generation that saw 1948. If you lived through the Shoah, through the Holocaust, and then you saw the creation of a Jewish state, that creates an indelible bond within you that no matter the politics that come after, you're always going to go back to that moment, you know, in your psyche. The next generation saw 1967, which was in less than a week, the threat against Israel's very existence, against its dramatic military victory, and just a few short years later, the Yom Kippur War, and that tracked them for their lives. My undergraduates have only been alive since the Intifada. In fact, the Intifada is almost twice as old as they are. And they have not in their life experience borne witness to anything that their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents' generation had. One of the arguments around birthright was it wanted to do or it wants to do for this generation what those earlier moments did, which is to say we need all of these young people 10 days in the country to have a powerful experience so that they will have an affective connection to Israel. So the combination, you know, of the political environment with sort of the lack of connection we've seen before, I think has led to a very strong generational marker in Israel attitudes.
Fair enough. Is there anything else, Professor Dullinger, before we leave this subject that you think we should be looking for as we're trending here on our program, looking at social, political developments going forward? Is there anything that you, as a scholar, would love to come back and analyze another 30 years down the road that you think may be in the offing as it relates to African-American and Jewish relations in America?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And academic historians have this, we critique what's called linear history or progressive history, which means history used to be bad, and then we learn the lessons of the past and we make the world better, which means like we're always getting to a better, until finally we'll get to some utopia. And the truth is history moves in every possible direction all the time, and it's not on a linear or progressive path. And sadly, the rise of anti-Semitism now is showing us, you know, that in some ways we're going backwards, and a generation from now, I would love to see how it is that this current generation of Jews and Jewish leaders are going to take the lessons of the larger culture to see about what kind of social justice they can do in a new and different way in the past, because the current moment is its own creation and offers its own possibilities.
Well said. Mark Dullinger, Black Power Jewish Politics, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
A pleasure. Outstanding questions. I really appreciate it.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.